yeah, there's times when I feel powerless of like, okay, so people talk about get an electric car, that'll be good for the environment. But when electric cars are coming out at like 40, 50, 60,000 pounds, and then, you know, if you have kids, then maybe you're talking like a seven-seater, so you're talking like 80 to 120 grand. Nobody has that. And so it's like, well, actually, maybe then I'll just carry on with my diesel seven-seater, and I have made a compromise out of my own position that actually I was powerless to change.
It's like with social media, people can't live without their phones. It's like, I've got to see what this, because I can't think for myself anymore. No one talks anymore. That's the thing. No one has a conversation about, oh, you know, like good ideas and stuff like that. It's everything's, look at that. Everyone's scrolling and it should be this and it should be that. It's like, you know what? I don't want any of that anymore. Let's start from scratch. It's got to that with me now.
It's very overwhelming for me because you want to help the planet, but also you want to help your wallet because you don't have that kind of economic power to buy better things. Yeah, you can go to the farmer's market, but obviously that is a bit more pricey. It's worth it, yes, but do you have that power? So it's really complicated. I do not know how to work with that.
In our daily lives, we often find ourselves ensnared within the web of consumer culture, navigating its enticing promises and grappling with its hidden costs. The stories of everyday people, striving to live in harmony with their surroundings while advocating for change in their own spheres, are the threads that weave the fabric of systemic transformation. Welcome to the last episode of System Shift Season 2, where we unearth the truth underlying our failing economic system, driving our planet beyond its limits, and chart a course towards a future defined by collective well-being and sufficiency. Today, for our final episode, we are joined by Helena Norberg-Hodge, a pioneer of the New Economy Movement, who for decades has encouraged social and environmental activists to move beyond treating symptoms and to focus on the need for fundamental change to the economy. Helena's story is itself a transformative and remarkable one. Initially, specializing in linguistics and studying under Noam Chomsky at MIT, she found herself, as we will hear, in the remote region of Ladakh, northern India. As a linguist joining a film team, she witnessed at first hand how the intrusion of the modern economy and consumer culture brought with it unemployment, abject poverty, environmental decline, and epidemics of depression and social divisiveness. In 1978, Helena established the Ladakh Project, dedicated to strengthening traditional organic agriculture and pioneering renewable energy alternatives, earning international recognition for its impact. She founded the international non-profit organization Local Futures, which has been pivotal in sparking localization movements in every continent. In this episode, Helena draws on a lifetime of expertise to unpack the hidden costs of our hyper-globalized world. Her words are not just visionary, but deeply practical, guiding us through a roadmap for reclaiming our sense of self that will bring us closer to reshaping our economies for the collective well-being of all. So, without further ado, a warm welcome to you, Helena.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm actually especially happy to have you as a guest because I've been working for so many years about localization, and one of the first things I read on this subject was something, a paper you wrote on local food economy, and it made a huge impact on me in how to find solutions. So I'm still grateful for that, even if it was decades ago.
It's so nice to hear that. Really nice to hear that. Localization is so important, and it's so urgent for people to start understanding the difference between blindly supporting a globalizing path instead of actively supporting a more localizing path.
If you ask a neoliberal theorist or a neoclassical economist or any guy in the agribusiness sector, they would always say, well, that's inefficient. It's much more efficient to have this huge monocultures. You can produce much more per hectare and it's much more profitable. What would you say to them?
Just imagine two pieces of land, and on one of them, you plant trees and bushes and vegetables, and you have some animals, and the animal poo goes on the land, and things ripen at different times, and you have the possibility of having far greater productivity than you ever can with just monoculture. If you plant just one thing, you will not be able to get as much out of that land as you will with diversity. And again, remember what's happened, you know, in these big industrial farms, you will have a big pig factory on one side of the country, and on the other side, where you might have some vegetables growing, people have to import fertilizer, and the fertilizer waste on the animal farms become toxic pollutants. So it's an insanity what's happened with modern industrial agriculture. The efficiency that we need to understand that was real, if you think of it as efficiency, was that you were able to produce more food with fewer people. But people are not a scarce resource. And so this is a really important wake-up call right now, that we need to realize that we have an overabundant renewable resource of human beings on this planet. And what is killing us on this planet is, at a fundamental level, about the fact that particularly with the advent of fossil fuels, but it started even before that, the modern economy was pushing people away from the land into resource-intensive cities and big machines using lots of oil. And because they were producing on big monocultures, they needed lots of chemicals, the chemical fertilizers, the chemical pesticides, the fungicides. And you end up with a system that actually produces less food per unit of land and creates massive pollution and is now responsible. The main cause of cancer, really, when you look at it honestly, is the unbelievable proliferation now of chemicals. Many of them, it would absolutely not be necessary if we just shifted policies in the same direction towards supporting more localized, more diversified food system. And we're talking also about making it a priority and a human right for people around the world to have the right to fresh, healthy, organic food as a priority. We really need to start carrying that flag, work with Via Campesina, which is one of the biggest social movements in the world, but many people haven't heard of it. It's about 300 million small farmers who have been trying to wake up in the Western world, the urban majority, to really understand what's happening to the food economy. I mean, there's so much more to say, but, you know, this efficiency is now also responsible for trans fats, high fructose corn syrup, et cetera, which is now recognized to be responsible for an epidemic of diabetes, obesity, and heart disease, and that this generation is going to die younger than their parent generation because of this. So you have toxic land with chemicals causing cancer. You've got toxic food that's creating all these health problems. And in the meanwhile, people who've been driven off the land into the cities, on the whole, are struggling to put food on the table and a decent roof over their head. We really must look at the reality on the ground and recognize that, particularly since the 80s, when this new era of globalization took off, and the argument was that it was lifting all boats and that people in India and China were going to be so much better off. If you actually now go and look at people's health and their well-being generally, their happiness, you will find the truth is that people are worse off and struggling. And as they struggle, we also see that friction increases between different groups.
So if you, rather than looking only at one single parameter without the costs, and you start checking, well, what is the net profit per hectare for a farmer with a diversified organic production and including then the chance for a reduced food waste because the local consumer will buy the carrot independently if it fits the general global export criteria and so on. So You mean that in the net benefit for humankind perspective, this is better, and that the economists had been suboptimizing for the wrong things, because now the lack is not human labor, but rather natural resources and healthy land and water.
Absolutely. And we really must look at the fact that this type of agriculture started with the birth of the modern economy. We need to go back to the roots to get a clear picture of the fact that the idea of comparative advantage, which is a fundamental principle in the modern economy, is that you're going to be better off in your region or your country if you specialize for export and then import whatever else you need. It is so important that we remember that these theories come off the back of enclosures, slavery, and genocide. And if we look back at the sort of forefathers of this economy, and that's why it is fair to call it patriarchal, although I don't find that very helpful today, but it's very important that to see that these white men from Europe, particularly England, formulated ideas where they explicitly express their misogyny, their disrespect for any other race. You know, it's not that long ago that people were even hunting Aboriginal people in Australia, I think as late as the 60s. And their values were also very explicitly anti-nature. Now, these people benefited enormously from driving people away from producing a range of products for themselves to produce the tea, the coffee, the whatever it might have been for export. And, you know, if there's anything in my thinking that could lead to a big wake-up today, it would be to look at that trajectory and to realize that we're talking about global traders starting the ball rolling and being part of formulating these economic theories, and that today we have a system where when we talk about this toxic global food system, we've got to remember that it also is based on import and export of identical food products. It's based on sending fish from Norway, from Australia, from America to China to be processed. On a daily basis, our basic needs are being flown and crisscrossing the world, and those emissions are not mentioned in the climate negotiation, not allowed to be mentioned. And once we realize that this is the root cause of most of our social and environmental problems, I think we're going to see a very, very powerful movement for change.
Why don't we just change recipes with each other? I think this approach is interesting, but the whole theory and comparative advantage, I think it was Ricardo, a British economist in the 19th century, so it's an old theory. It was like based on a colonial logic already then, but what has been aggravating since then is also the financialization of it. So local farmers selling on the global market now needs to sell their crop when it's harvested. But because of the extreme fluctuation of prices linked to financial speculation, that, for example, more than half of the wheat, the week after Ukraine invasion, it was banks who created contracts that had no link to reality. They just thought the wheat price will go up because Ukraine is a big exporter. Now they can't export. So we will just speculate on wheat without no intention of ever selling or buying it. But it inflated the price and created inflation and aggravated the global crisis. This is then added to it because, of course, the profits of these fluctuations will land in the banks rather than in the farmer's hands. So this is making this theory even worse than when he invented it. I think that's exactly. Also an important thing.
Yeah, very important. And I do think once we go back to those roots and we look at the role of the global players, we'll see that banking also started changing as mm-hmm. Europeans moved out from Europe to conquer other people, to steal their resources, often committing, you know, genocide and so on. At the same time, the banking systems changed, shifting towards fractional reserve, towards dealing with money in a way that most people didn't understand. They didn't realize.
And for those who don't understand it, term fractional reserve banking, I can recommend the first season episode with Anne Pettifor, where we explain how money is created today.
Yeah, and it basically means that we think that we put the money in the bank and the bank keeps it. No, they changed the rules so that they could just use most of our money to invest and to expand and to grow their wealth, not our wealth. So I think it's really, really helpful to be able to look back and to see the roots of this system. And as you say, to realize that things have escalated in a way that is truly mad. And I really believe that most people would absolutely not support these policies. But this is the tragedy, is that both left and right politically, and even the Greens, haven't done their job focusing on really explaining what this economic theory is all about, and particularly not looked at this process of deregulating global banks and businesses, which started after the Second World War, when the IMF and the World Bank were set up. At the same time, they set up something called the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And this was actually a process of allowing corporations and banks to have the freedom to go in and out of every country. So they were pressuring governments to go along with this. And there were lots of good intentions in that. People were superficially thinking, this is how we prevent another world war. This is how we prevent another depression. If we're all interlinked economically, we will be so interdependent that we are not going to fight each other. Well, of course, the interdependence was actually not an interdependence between people. It was people from Uruguay to Sweden to America becoming dependent on global corporations and banks that were becoming richer and richer and richer. And in the 80s, there was a new push for this process to continue and to be more forcefully imposed on government, and that it came with something called the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was originally the name that was brought in at the Bretton Woods or when the IMF and the World Bank were set up. But now this is this new Uruguay round of the GATT. Anyway, I became alerted to this by Malaysian colleagues. And when I learned about this, which was in the 80s, I was so relieved because now I suddenly understood that we didn't have to fight this system on every corner and the often, every sailing, every forest, every river, you know, fighting for the poor, because here was a central trajectory that was so clearly destructive. So free trade was freedom for Monsanto, for Coca-Cola, to go into countries and destroy the local economy, usually also subsidized by their governments. They could bring in products from the other side of the world at a lower price than products that were produced a 5-minute walk away. And, you know, I witnessed this in Ladakh or Little Tibet, which is where my eyes were open to all of this.
Your experience in Ladakh is really interesting in the way that if you have a problem now to imagine how a world without the current neoliberal capitalist logic of economy is based, I think you, if you tell a little bit about the way people lived in Ladakh when you first arrived, there could be a help to guide you how a different mindset rather than competition can be replaced with cooperation. If you would be so kind to tell a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this was definitely where my eyes were opened very, very wide. I was living in Paris. I was a linguist. I'm Swedish, both my parents half Swedish, but also English and German. I had lived in all three countries, learned quite a lot of languages, and had also studied and lived in France and in other countries, also America. And I thought that I learned about lots of different cultures. But when I arrived in Ladakh, I actually arrived in a culture that had not been colonized. And later on, I understand that it was also very important that the Christian missionaries who had come out had not succeeded in converting anybody except a few orphans. So there was a tiny minority of Christians, but other people had not been influenced. But I realized more recently that in so many cultures, the Christian missionaries already brought this message that you're inferior, you're backward. And look, you know, in Europe, we have these amazing tools and technologies. And of course, they were also forerunners often for this sort of rape of resources back to Europe. But anyway, I discovered then a culture that had not been affected by the missionaries, not colonized, and not developed, because it's a part of Tibet that belongs politically to India. It's the westernmost part of Tibet. And it had been sealed off by Indian army as the Chinese had started coming in to central Tibet. And because it was so remote, it had been protected by being up at about 12,000 feet is where people live, about 3,500 meters, and surrounded by high Himalayan mountains. So it was a very arduous journey to get there before there were airplanes. And I arrived there as it's just been opened up by the Indian government for outside visitors. And I had been asked to go as part of a German film team to help make a documentary by picking up a little bit of the language of these people. I thought I'd be there for 6 weeks, but I was absolutely astounded by the beauty of the place and the people, by the joy, by the incredible vitality and laughter. So I fell in love immediately. When the filming was finished, I had already picked up quite a lot of the language. And I started working on a thesis, thinking I was going to do a PhD on language. But as that process developed, I became more and more involved in working with the local people to try to find a way of meeting the modern world that wasn't going to destroy their local economy, and above all, not destroy their self-respect. Because I saw how the media that came in, the schooling that was coming in, all created this sense that these people are stupid and backward.
In your book, I think there is a rather interesting episode where you describe a man on a bus and some tourists ask him to do a lot of things for them. And he does it without being servile, and he does it keeping with his dignity, and he doesn't even get angry. Another man who is taunted all the time when he's walking on the street, he doesn't really care. This sense of inner security that makes you, you know, above the competition-based taunting and bullying we have in our societies. Where does that come from, do you think?
Well, thanks so much. Such good questions. And I'm glad you remember that from my book, Ancient Futures, you know, about the traditional culture and the changes I witnessed there. Yeah, I think I really became an expert in understanding where that deep, deep self-esteem and security came. And it became over the years so clear that it was connected to having a very extended family, so that every mother had about 5 to 10 caretakers for every baby. So for every child, there were all these welcoming arms. And particularly beautiful was that in every household, you know, the extended family was such that the eldest, you know, the 80-year-old uncle, walking hand in hand with a one-year-old child, they were the best friends. You know, they were both very slow. They could barely walk. They could barely chew. They were both toothless, hairless, and moved very slowly. They were made for each other. Now, that security that came from that, and it wasn't, oh, you know, every eye focus on the child, but it was this calm and complete and sort of forever sense of belonging and being cared for. And part of that, I came to realize, led to also a greater sense of individualism, because people were accepted as they were, because they had not yet been had the imposition of Christianity or later development with the idea that you're so imperfect and, you know, we all have to be on this path of improvement, because we're all basically having to reject our bodies, our senses. We're all striving for a type of progress, because there was instead that deep acceptance of what is an acceptance of the here and now, that also meant that deep acceptance of the child and later on of, you know, adults too. So you actually were able to, in a relaxed way, to be yourself. And then I witnessed how, with development, suddenly images came in and pressures, and including the Western schooling, advertising. And now suddenly the message was, you are nobody unless you come into the city and you've got the latest Nike shoes and you're drinking the right Coca-Cola, because this is a superior culture and you're backward. And essentially the schooling also taught that, sometimes very explicitly. Sometimes the lessons, you know, for children would actually say, we've got to do everything we can to get these illiterate farmers into the city so that they can, you know, become, essentially become more human. So it was this onslaught that I saw led to insecurity in both little girls and little boys, particularly in the early stages. It was so clear how vulnerable children are. But over the years, even adults were affected by this. And the end result was also, in the 80s, literally toy shops coming in and adverts where it was Rambos for boys and Barbie dolls for girls. And interestingly enough, my husband and I had lived, my husband had joined me after 3 years when I had been out there doing work. He'd been trained as a barrister, but had gone to South America for a break before he started working. And he'd come back to London, very interested in indigenous cultures. And I met him there, and he then joined me. And we had lived in Ladakh for half of every year. And it was very hard then to live in a sort of typical modern city. So we sought out one of the most remote parts of Spain in Andalusia and bought land there and were thinking of living more in that eco-community way, in community, close to the land, which, you know, Ladakh really inspired, and which is also why I've been part of the Global Eco-Village Network and so on. But we saw in those Spanish villages, so much later than Ladakh, you know, these villages had been through the Inquisition, they'd had Muslim invasions, women, you know, often dressed in black, not that incredible, joyous openness that we found in predominantly Buddhist Ladakh, but they still had intergenerational community much more than, say, in Scandinavia or England. They would still be singing flamenco together, and you would find in the sort of disco late at night a 90-year-old granny and a little baby together with the whole family. And you also found that people were still producing a lot of their food. They had citrus, they were making cheese, you could, you know, the cows that the milk came from or the goats were on the hills. They had hamon, you know, ham production from the little black pigs that used to graze in the forest. And we witnessed there too the imposition of the outside economy, destroying the local food production and bringing in gradually, you know, at first a small supermarket, after that a bit bigger. And it was amazing to see how much was still intact in Spain as late as the 80s. And it was tragic to see that in the 80s, when this new form of globalization took off, that it had such a big impact there too. In fact, I just want to add that if we look back over change in these last 40 years, we'll see that almost every corner of the planet will have seen more environmental breakdown, more social breakdown, and it's been concomitant with a rise in emissions, a rise in pollution, and very serious environmental consequences.
I think it was really interesting when you mentioned the form of individualism that you found in Ladakh based on inner sense of security and identity. I mean, in our culture, individualism is praised as something very good. But still, it's also failing in a sense that many people feel really insecure on who they are and why they are here on this planet. And And they try to replace this insecurity with buying the security of having the brands who have spent billions of dollars to create an image about who you are if you buy this brand. So it's interesting to see that even if we have a culture of, you know, praising individualism, we are failing to feel it deep inside us and have this inner security that gives you community and content and a base in society.
Yeah, and especially that gives you the confidence to be yourself. So we have to realize that exactly the opposite is happening. The message to the child is only if you have the right car, the right clothes, the right exterior, or even, you know, if you have a PhD and you're important, only then will you be loved. And so it's truly evil to see this happening to young children. The message is, if you go down this path of consumerism, you'll get the love and sense of belonging that all of us long for. Instead, what it does is to create ever-increased competition and insecurity. So it is truly an evil system that does that to our identity and to our sense of being. It's very paradoxical in a way, I suppose, but it's the what we're seeing is not individualism. What's being touted is that, you know, we're free and individual, but actually we're living in fear and angst about conforming in a way that will give us the love we need. And that was projected by the media and then got worse with television. And of course, now with social media, it's got even worse. And you have six-year-old girls who are afraid to even go off their mobile phone for a few minutes because they're afraid of being left behind. And they're taking images of themselves constantly to show what a great time they're having. And then sending that image out, all of it building more insecurity, more fear, and more disconnection, and, you know, no sense of real connection. Because to feel really connected, we need to know that people know who we are. They need to know us better. They need to know also that we're not perfect, that we have problems. I mean, I think this combination of a deep insight into how this corporate global economy affects our inner well-being, the relationship, that long distance between my inner well-being, how do I feel about myself, and what's happening out there in that global economy. That is really what our work is about in Local Futures, trying to open people's eyes to that. I feel we have a very powerful message for helping to build a much, much stronger movement for change than what we're seeing, you know, particularly again, in these last 30, 40 years, there's been a pressure on the environmental movement to move in the direction of treating symptoms, a narrow focus, and all the time painting a picture where the individual is to blame. So I feel, you know, this great sadness for people, particularly in the West, who are being made to feel that they're responsible for the planet dying, they're responsible for poverty in the third world, they're responsible for not doing anything about climate change, and it's because they're so selfish and greedy and they don't care. And that message is so wrong. And my experience is that a lot of people do care and they're trying really hard to make change, but they're being pinned in a corner by government policy that systematically subsidizes and supports global corporations and their wealth accumulation, subsidizes and supports big global banks that, by the way, are also making money out of thin air, and at the same time are squeezing and taxing the individual and local, place-based, regional, even national businesses. They're being squeezed with regulations and taxes. Those global subsidized multinationals have no rules. No rules. That's what free trade is about. The treaties are about giving them more freedom, no constraints. And I do think we really need to get people to look at the ISDS clauses in those trade treaties. That stands for investor-state dispute settlements, where governments are signing in black and white to big corporations, we won't do anything that might reduce your profit. If we do, you can take us to court.
And that's exactly also why we explained that a little bit more in our episode with Janu.
Oh, very good, very good. I am so convinced that left, right, green, people concerned with social issues, including the epidemic of depression now. You know, we're just talking about this impact of social media and this pressure on young people. It is in every country that I know about, including now in Ladakh, leading to epidemics of depression among young people and ever-increasing rates of suicide. And in Ladakh, suicide is something that might have happened in a generation and certainly never young people. Now it'll be at least one a month and young people.
That's all over the world, actually, because in the latest WHO, they declared loneliness as the main cause of psychological illness in the world today. And that's also a consequence of this economic system you're describing. It doesn't only pressure people from the outside, you're pressured from the inside. And it forces you to go against what you know is good for your well-being, spending time on relations and cooperating, rather competing and pressing. And, you know, making people lonely, making people alone also internally. And then you just follow the race because that's the only way to show that you are someone and get some love from the society. So this is actually breaking down these relationships that we all know makes us happy, and research backs that up.
And it's so interesting to reflect on the fact that in all the big cities that I have ever been to in the world, I've been to a lot, I've worked in so many different countries, and in the big city, we don't look each other in the eye, we don't say hello, we pass each other in this really unnatural way. In smaller towns and villages, people look each other in the eye and say hello, even if they don't know each other personally. What I've come to realize is that also this more land-based way of life was based on us being interdependent. We depended on each other. And that's partly what we're seeing now in the new localization movement, as we were talking about in the farmers market, that we're starting to build these bonds of interdependence that are mutually supportive, like the consumer with the farmer and the small shop that you know the person who runs it. So traditionally, that's how we evolved, interdependent and, very importantly, in a multi-generational relationship, not segregated into monocultures. So this is also connected to that for the extractive global economy, technology has been a tool for bringing more wealth to the top. And it was already with that industrial agriculture. It helped extract more wealth for big business. And even when governments thought that they were subsidizing wheat and wheat farmers, they weren't actually supporting the farmers. They were supporting Kellogg's and the big giants that processed that and sold it to the consumer. Once you start looking at that difference between people being made dependent on distant, essentially global or giant corporations and banks versus being interdependent with one another, you see a different picture from what we normally think about. But then you add to that that the technologies were responsible for speeding life up. So they speeded up production so that big machine that harvested, you know, could do it a lot faster than, you know, if you had lots of humans doing it in the field, which, by the way, is also why many people didn't question modern agriculture, because often what preceded it were colonial relationships where people were working like slaves, you know, standing all day in a cotton field, you know, just picking cotton like a machine, horrible. So then to bring in a machine looks like real progress. That's, again, the key in localization, is to understand the deeper roots and to go back more to indigenous culture to find examples of what really works. But then the thing that's key is for us to really look at how speed is just an evil, evil way of destroying relationships, a relational way of being. To care for and for those parents to see that child and to be present, you know, they need not to be pushed all the time to worry about earning a living and putting food on the table, paying the rent, paying the mortgage. And this speed leads to superficiality. So I also wrote about that in my book, Ancient Futures, about Ladakh, because I saw so clearly how it changed human relationships. And the superficiality in turn, the speed leads to superficiality. The superficiality leads to this feeling of emptiness, because you're basically seen for what you look like on the outside, not who you are on the inside. And you only get those relationships of deeper connection when you have more time to know each other, to care for each other. And the same thing for the animals, the plants, the waterways that we depend on.
I think when you talk about relational economy as compared to transactional economy, it's really interesting because, of course, it has an impact on people. If you hide the consequences of production in a transaction, every dollar that buys something is a fair transaction according to modern economic theory, but it hides the relational cost and the distancing from consumers, producers, and people and people. And this, of course, has an internal and external cost, I would say.
Absolutely. And remember also the hiding happens when these distances are so long that you're sitting in New York investing in something in Malaysia and you have no experiential knowledge, you rely on numbers, you're told it's all nicely taken care of, the labor isn't abused. And as a consumer, you're going to the supermarket, you have no idea who produced the food, how many chemicals, and more, you know, you can't trust a lot of the information. So this is, again, the beauty of the local. When you start getting the shorter distances, you have more experiential knowledge. And this is a key. Here I'm talking more about structures than I am about values. I'm seeing that when people are more structurally interdependent and in a more human scale, slower, smaller situations, which can be created in the city. You know, there are examples of people coming together, even in big cities, start creating the interdependence there and building bonds that then allow for much more accountability, but also you can see that sense of belonging, that sense of being known, that sense of being appreciated for what you do. And we all need that. We all need to be seen and heard and to feel that we belong. Basically, it comes down to having a need to be loved.
I find it funny in a way because a neoclassical economist would say, oh, but you're not realistic, you hate the market and this is not working. But if you go back to Adam Smith's original theory about market and based on full information of the things you're buying, your model is actually coming much closer to the original market theories on based on full information and feedback loop of information and so on. So it's kind of ironic that the modern version of believing in the market is actually destroying it with global monopolies and lack of information among each other.
Exactly. But also do keep in mind, as I say, the early stages of this was global traders, you know, in the slave trade, the cotton, the tea, the coffee. It's so important, I think, that we learn to think about the global system as an almost sort of empire that's behind the scene is running thing. And we need to do that without getting caught up in conspiracy theories where we think, you know, oh, it's just the Freemasons or just, you know, particular groups, but really looking at the structures of that. So again, if we could get people to look at governments are taxing, subsidizing, and regulating to shape the direction of the economy moving forward, to shape the future. And they are now continuing to deregulate these giant global corporations that, you know, most people are aware they are too big, they are too powerful. But very few people are talking about the fact that governments are continuing to roll out the red carpet and that actually they're taking their marching orders from global corporations. And I think that what's needed is the people's movement that insists on clarity and honesty about this, and that starts a process of international collaboration, international negotiations. We're starting this journey where those businesses are going to be forced to belong to a democratically accountable unit. They're no longer going to have this carte blanche to do as they like and to give our countries their marching order. That would be a way of massively reducing emissions, for instance. I mean, one of the first things that would be implemented is that, sorry, we're not going to keep importing oranges when we have our own oranges. We're not going to keep importing milk when we've got our own milk. If that redundant, what we call insane trade, would be within a year prevented, the damage, the social disruption, so would be minimal to society. It would be a great improvement for the environment. What would be affected would be the profits of those corporations. But that in and of itself is something that needs to happen.
The global trade, of course, a large share of it is also made for internal tax reasons among companies rather than actual practical needs.
Yeah, I feel if we can get the bigger picture out and the message is, please don't blame yourself. Please instead wake up to the economic trajectory, to the economic system. Join a movement for curtailing this exploitation, for shifting the direction of the economy. Let's realize that stopping the import and export of the same products, and it's not just food. I mean, food is the most dramatically ridiculous, but it's happening with plastic waste. It's happening with batteries, uranium, old growth, forest logs, import and export. That stopping that would massively reduce emissions systemically. So we have solutions there, but we need to come together to create the political momentum and the honest discussion out there. It's beginning to happen. I'm very pleased now that the sort of corruption at these COP meetings is beginning to be explored more. Sustainable ethical investment is also being exposed more for what it is. So again, without demonizing particular people, particular businesses, just clarity. You know, we have a message that can help people feel less bad about themselves. And then what we're recommending is starting right now the journey of localization. And that's a journey of reconnection. So we're saying that if you come together in the area where you live with like-minded people, and you start exploring a journey that is both about personal well-being, but also healing the planet by understanding the big picture, we have a very positive vision to offer people. And our big problem is it's very difficult to get into the media.
I think that's a really nice way to think about it, because we need both the inner development of people, the creation of local cooperation among people, but we also definitely need to do something about that. The farmer taking his or her truck to the market is going to pay more fuel taxes than the executive flying his private jet from New York to London, or the boat with produce from bananas to Brazil to Europe. They're going to pay less taxes and fuel taxes on that trip than the farmer going to the local market. So this shows that the system is rigged. The system is rigged for the global economy, not for the local economy, and that's destroying our planet and creating unnecessary emissions that are easily abated.
Exactly. But then again, you know, what I became aware of as I had my eyes open to a lot of this in Ladakh, and by the way, you know, one of the first things was seeing butter that had been transported over the Himalayas and transported for a couple of weeks, comes in and sells for half the price of butter that's been produced, a five-minute walk away, exactly as you were saying.
Why was it sold at half the price? What made it the production of it so cheap in monetary terms? How come? How could they produce it so cheap?
This is where it gets very tricky, because what I try to spell out in my book, in Ancient Futures, is that I saw the systemic levers whereby the education for urbanization, for urban jobs, the crowding together in the city there, or destroying the local production just structurally, became part of this systemic buildup, creating more dependence on far away. You have to look at the really big picture to look at the roots of it. You have to see, you know, not just the education alone, but then the subsidies for energy already starting, you know, right at the beginning of this development. So that energy is subsidized for those trucks, just as you were saying, to come from weeks away over the Himalayan mountains, creating massive clouds of pollution, et cetera, et cetera. So it's amazing how big the win-win-win is of localizing. But I also just want to add here, because I think a very important point about localization that people don't understand is we're talking here about economic localization. We're talking about economic globalization. And it's particularly important that we distinguish between economic globalization and international collaboration. So economic globalization has been this process of allowing corporations to move as they like, to have no rules, and also not to pay any taxes. Completely unfair playing field. But what we really need to recognize is that this process has been going on. You know, people are blind to it. Most economists are not looking at the consequences of it. They're not being forced to look at, oh, what's happened here to create this unemployment, to create the discontent, to create the pollution. There has not been a big picture analysis of this.
What was the unemployment rate in Ladakh when you first arrived there?
It never existed. You know, for thousands of years, no such thing as unemployment. No such thing as real poverty. But also what I want to say is that international collaboration is more important than ever today. So many people who confuse the two and who think that globalization is about collaboration, they become quite anti-localization because they think it's some kind of selfish retreat and some kind of nasty protectionism. But
I think we can take the buttress good example there that you talked about. Like, yeah. Why is it economically half the price? Well, it's of course, because feed for the giant cattle farms, industry farms, it's imported from somewhere else without paying the taxes, without paying the cost of deforestation for its feed production, without giving the workers reasonable working conditions or salaries. It's based on externalizing all the costs of the production of that butter. That's why it's cheaper. So it's only cheaper in monetary terms when you buy it. The cost for society and environment and the necessary climate and environmental adaptations, that's going to be paid by the taxpayer or future generations. So it's fake cheap butter. That's important to remember, I think.
Yeah, I want to say that it's also really important to remember that when you have more small-scale economies, the externalities are obvious. If you had a town, even a town of, say, you know, 10,000, there's no way that they could cut all the trees down and call that progress. They wouldn't be able to have an insanity like GDP. They wouldn't be able to have all these externalities, because the whole point is that when you're feeling yourself from that land around you that is visible, it's experiential knowledge, you also know that you want to have enough water for it, and you're not going to be wasting it on luxuries when you know that you need it for your well-being and for producing the things you really need. So key, again, is the scale. So the scale of the global economic activity has automatically created this blindness to so-called externalities.
I think that's really interesting. Like, if you would have a psychopathic company leader in that town destroying the stream's water quality where all the children of the town are swimming, that would not be considered a successful leader. It will be hated by the whole society.
Exactly. And partly that hate, that disapproval, and on the other side, the approval. Because don't forget, so many people are driven by wanting to be admired. And so we see a lot of these billionaires now showing off with their yachts and their this and that. Because actually, this is what's driving people. But one thing I also want to say very importantly about localization is that we are not advocating for a world where you couldn't have bigger businesses and where they would be stopped from collaborating with other businesses in other countries. So many people today believe that we couldn't have even the telephone or the airplane or the car or any of these modern technologies without globalization. So let's remind our listeners, no, globalization saying that big businesses don't have to have any rules, not even any real accountability in terms of how much pollution they emit and how many toxic chemicals, that is not something that most people would approve of. So global collaboration, even between business, will be fine. However, what is not fine is that those global corporations move around without any rules and impose on our governments their needs to extract more profit from us.
That's so true. And it's ironic that it's called deregulation. So it's like, it's not even the terminology deregulation is true. It's re-regulating everything to favor the biggest, the strongest, and the financial sector. That's important to remember.
Again, you know, one could write a book about it because it is, as I say, a driver of people rejecting and resenting government interference. But it's because no one has spelled out to them that what governments are implementing is actually the wishes of these global corporations and banks, that they've become subservient to them.
But I think you should see then the root causes. Like, often the greenies or lefties are accused of wanting more regulation. But people fail to see the root cause is that we have deregulated the global corporations. We have taken away relationship-based economy with a transaction-based economy where you lose the trust in each other. So if you have a society with no trust, then you need to regulate more in order to avoid people exploiting the lack of regulation because there's no trust keeping people in control.
I'm so hoping that in the next few years we will see the new economy movements growing and growing so that when they talk about systems change, they really do take on looking more clearly and honestly at the global economic system. I'm quite fed up with hearing a lot about systems change, but very little about a truly honest analysis and study of how the global economic system operates, how it is literally the same corporations and banks having an impact on virtually every corner of the world, having an impact on life itself. And I think people are rightly calling it a death economy because it is now so full of toxic ways of dealing, you know, human destruction, environmental destruction. I think that building that movement, perhaps the most important thing right now would be to study the impact of that global economy and look at its impact on people in terms of pushing them to run faster and faster, to just put food on the table and a roof over their head. Remember, the calculations are not very helpful if they simply look at, oh, how many dollars are they earning now as opposed to 10 years ago? The way to show the crime that's happening would be to look at how many hours are you working to just meet that basic need of food and shelter. The middle class in virtually every country is getting poorer and poorer. And you know, I was talking earlier about time, and it's so scary because it also takes time for people to just look up and be willing to think about where things are heading as they're being pushed more and more to just deal with those basic needs. It's very hard for them to take the time to do that.
And then adding all the unnecessary, not beneficial, forced choices of the neoliberal economy takes even more time away from people.
Absolutely.
But let's say you would then have the power to change laws and regulations and financial system. Where would you start?
Well, I mean, really, it would be, if I were emperor of the world, I would call together the social and environmental movement. And, you know, once there was a wake up, we would be insisting on sitting around the table with governments to start regulating the global and look at creative decentralization or localization, which would involve a certain amount of deregulation of the local, of the things that prevent eco-villages, for instance, that prevent healthy farming, often in the name of preventing sprawl and so on. It's a lot of it is nonsense. So it would be a question of that process of regulating the global, which, as I say, could almost overnight bring huge benefits and prevent that import and export of identical products, and also ensure that those giants are starting to pay tax. But the goal would be to move in the direction where over a few years they have to choose a place, and they are going to be there, and they're going to be accountable to that society, and probably what would need to be to remain would be something like a WEF, you know, World Environmental Forum, instead of a World Trade Organization or a World Economic Forum. So the World Environmental and Social Forum, that
yeah,
would
exactly.
be through international collaboration with the vigilance of people closer to the ground, people actually in a more decentralized, localized ways, with eyes open, providing information to the center, which is not an easy task, but is also not impossible. And it's certainly not impossible to provide that information in the local area and the region. And we're already seeing in the localization movement the benefits of that. And we really are seeing particularly the worldwide local food movement demonstrating these multiple benefits, you know, reducing emissions in transport, reducing plastic packaging, reducing the need for the chemicals, the preservatives, the, you know, encouraging more diversified, genuinely organic production, rebuilding community. And very importantly, as people connect over soil and seed, we're seeing a spiritual healing, a psychological healing that is so inspiring. You know, I've seen prisoners, I've seen torture victims, I've seen depressed people who have deeply benefited from that reconnection of building the community and building the deep connection to nature, and including in that, the production of something that everybody needs and wants and values, which is tasty, healthy food.
Oh, thank you so much for this, Helena. I think it's kind of an interesting mind-opening thing here, that for people who really want deregulation, you need to switch from the current economy to a trust and relationship-built one, where you can deregulate because the community would step in and do the reasonable and necessary measures to make sure you're within the line of the community. I think if you... So all you neoliberals and right-wing people who want this deregulation, the reason why you get so much regulation is because we have deregulated in favor of giant corporations, and the society fights back against the negative impact. So if you want to have real deregulation, start fighting for decentralization, trust-based economy, relationship-based economy, then you would have a bigger chance of getting that. That's my final call, I think. Thank you so much for opening my eyes for that.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for doing this podcast, and hope to be in touch again.